With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to episode 75 of The Hi-Lo, the weekly current affairs and pop culture podcast brought to you by journalists Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes.
Did you have a nice week off?
I don't know if I can call it a week off. It was a week off work, but it was a week on babying. But it was great. It was so nice to have that week with her. I am still ill, though, after 5 weeks, which is quite boring, and my sleeping is still terrible. But I'm now taking vitamins, which sounds a bit like you recommending the Sainsbury's app.
Yeah,
like,
do you
know discovered
what?
Vitamin
it's
C.
It's so funny. I'm amazed that I didn't get more abuse for recommending the Sainsbury's app. I didn't get one arsey high-low
more abuse
listener.
Than me.
The only person who did pick it up was my friend India, who I saw on Friday, and she was like, by the way, you know when you were doing the recommendations on the Hi-Lo this week? And I was like, yeah. She was like, was it sponsored? And I was like, what do you mean? She said it was sponsored, wasn't it? Right,
by all those. You can't actually be recommending those apps.
And I was like, no, of course it wasn't sponsored. It was that we'd have to say it was just me recommending it. And she was like, that was weird. Did you just not read anything last week? I was like, well, kind of. But I don't know. Apparently, it's not been very helpful to anyone, so I'm very sorry. I won't ever do it again. But she was also like, you're the biggest Luddite and you don't know how to use your phone or apps.
That's why it's so monumentous.
Yeah, she's like, I'm not going to listen to what you have to say about apps.
So did you say, well, thank you, India, for your contribution. You've really bolstered my sense of self today.
She also listened to the Lindsay Hilsum episode 3 times last week because she liked it so much.
I think that's a bit much.
Well, this is also the girl who's gone to go see A Star Is Born at the cinema 3 times.
India, what's going on with you? Is 3 the magic number?
She's very obsessive. Anyway, what vitamins are you recommending, Pandora?
I'm definitely not getting down that. Oh, God. And also, God love anyone who is kind enough to do so, but please don't email me telling me what supplements I can take or all sorts. I'm handling it.
Yeah.
Very kind, all the suggestions of CBD oil. When
she's
I begin my
it.
Cannabis lifestyle, I will absolutely take to the CBD oil. But yeah, I'm across it. So, you know,
when are you going to start the cannabis lifestyle, do you think? Because I'm excited about that. I live right next to Camden Market. I'm very much here for you when that happens.
Can you imagine? It would absolutely throw everyone. It's so against my personality type. How was your week?
Dolly
sent me a message going, I have to let you know, I've been drunk for most of this week and it's great. How are you feeling this week?
It wasn't great, actually. I have to say, it wasn't great. It's awful. I can't. Do you know what it is? I've realised that I'm really struggling now as a 30-year-old to work out how to spend free time, like how to relax. And I think because what I used to default to in my 20s was just getting so drunk, I sometimes do that and it just makes me. I'm like in recovery now for a week.
It does take a week though.
It takes a week. If you drink for more than 3 days over a week, then you need a holiday.
Preaching to the long converted. And how was Venice? Did it smell? These are the rumours I always hear.
Didn't smell. Have you ever been?
No, dying to go, actually. I want to go for my birthday.
Should
I go for my
definitely
birthday?
Definitely go for your birthday. When's your birthday again,
March.
Such a dick. I'm such a bad friend. Please, can we take that out? Because I will not hear the end of it.
We're not taking it out. It's staying in. And you'll have all heard how Dolly tried to get it taken out.
I'm going to have
Venice.
So many high-low listeners tell me that I'm a bad friend.
What do you say?
I'm sorry, it's because I'm not on Facebook anymore.
I know. It's seriously hard. Dolly, I still don't know Ollie's birthday. I know it's the 4th or the 5th of May. That's so angry.
Anyway, March. Yes, I think that would be fine. Well, apparently now in Venice, there's no such thing as out of season. Because it's just, it's so, and that's the thing I would say, it's the most breathtakingly.
You stayed in a sumptuous looking hotel.
Yeah, it was gorgeous.
Could you just step out onto a gondola?
Yeah, but the amazing thing about Venice is like every corner of it looks like Venice. The whole, it's so aesthetically beautiful, jaw-droppingly so. but it's also jaw-droppingly touristy. It's the most touristy place I've ever been
in my
entire life.
That's the most touristy place I've ever been.
I think it's... I haven't been to Rome, but I think it's like... I mean, I didn't hear Italian the entire time I was there.
Is it the most jaw-dropping expensive place you've ever been?
Yeah, really expensive. But it's worth it because it's so grand
and
it's
Venice,
so beautiful.
The Venetian lifestyle for a few days.
Yeah. The other thing I would say if anyone's going to Venice is you have to book all your dinners like a week before.
Did you do that?
No. So I had all these fabulous recommendations and none of them I could get into. I ate well, but for me, part of it is discovering all the great restaurants and we couldn't get in anywhere.
And how was your first ever holiday with your mum?
Oh, she was great. She was
great.
So
you recommend the mum and daughter mini break?
Yeah. Have you ever done it before?
No. I'm picturing in my head. It would be quite funny. I should. I think we want quite different things from a mini break.
Really? See, that's the thing with any holidaying partner. Like, I've worked out with my friends who I'm on the same wavelength with. Because you said you and Ollie are so compatible with what you want from a holiday.
I think we've met a lot in the middle. But I definitely think if you're someone that likes getting up at 8 or 9 in the morning, going on a mini break with someone that wants to wake up at 12 would be really boring. Mm. It's just quite basic, those requirements.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing is it's also like... How much of it is... So me and my mum are on the same wavelength that, like, a big part of discovering a place is just, like, noodling around. So for my mum and I, kind of wandering around is as important as, like...
Poodling.
Poodling. My mum used that word all the time.
I love poodling. My favourite is waddling, just because it's just so...
Tell you what, after all that pistachio gelato, I was bloody waddling.
You were waddling. But you didn't have a total week off. You did... Two stunning performances of Everything I Know About Live.
Thanks, Angel.
One of which I came to see.
Yes, I noticed you didn't come to the matinee as well, and I would be lying to say it didn't hurt a little.
That I didn't give up 5 hours of my Sunday. But it was really fascinating because I said to Dolly...
That is Zadie having a little bit of a chat next door.
She's quite upset that she didn't come to Everything I Know About Love. But I said to Dolly, it was really weird, but in like a really good way, watching... You on stage, not sitting next to you, because I've never actually seen you without being next to you in a kind of live audience sense.
Normally, beforehand, me having a complete meltdown before being like, I'm so nervous.
I have to say, it was quite nice being in a stage format, but like not sweating myself.
Yes,
so it was entirely sweaty, but I was still on the edge of my seat because I was really invested in like you not making a gaffe. So it was as if I was up there.
That's kind of like, that's sweet, because that's kind of like how you feel, I imagine. Like,
as a mum?
Yeah, when you see Zadie doing the nativity, and you'll just be like, oh, please don't mess it up.
Yeah, watching you felt like watching a nativity
film. Oh, that's so nice. I loved having you there. It was really, because you were...
No, I was very proud of you. For anyone else that's booked their tickets, you're in for a treat.
Thanks, darling. Did you have any other revelations from your week off?
I did, Dolly. I discovered whole milk in coffee.
I would argue that that is akin to me discovering the Sainsbury's app, but I'll let it go.
It's delicious. I can see why people get quite kind of obsessed with having the blue milk. It's a different coffee experience.
Do you know what, as well, if someone's worried about calories with semi-skimmed and whole milk, it's really not that much difference.
No, there's a lot of other things that are probably more.
And did you notice that if you're making coffee at home with whole milk, it foams up properly? In a way that semi-skimmed doesn't as well.
No, I didn't notice that, actually.
Have a little experiment at home.
I'll have a little
experiment. So are you now going to have whole milk in all your coffees?
I did want to see if I start having whole milk and everything, if I get larger. It was a bit like in my last few weeks of pregnancy, where I started putting cream in everything, because I was just like, fuck.
Oh, I remember that phase.
Fuck this. So everything that, literally everything that Ollie ate, he'd be like, this is delicious, what have you put in? And I'd be like, cream.
My friend Alex, when she went over to, she lives in New York, and when she first went there, at coffee shops, when they offer you all the different milks, they offer half and half, and she thought half
big
and
thing
half
in America, isn't it?
Was semi-skimmed milk. Half and half is single cream. So she was like, for the first month she was in New York, she's like, God, coffee is so good here.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's single cream.
That's amazing.
And, coffee with single cream.
Can you tell me what the difference between single cream and double cream is?
Do you know what? I cannot, but I'm sure we have some dairy farmers out there. Well, we've got one in New Zealand, haven't we?
Let us know. Part of my whole milk and coffee thing is because I didn't have a total week off last week. One of the things that I did is hosted a panel talk on self-care. Now,
oh, interesting.
Previous listeners or regular listeners of the High Low might know I am very dismissive of the term self-care. In fact, probably before this year, I was quite dismissive of anything that was really to do with looking after yourself. As of the past few weeks, I am now really interested. So hosting this panel could not have come at a better time. And I interviewed all these different people that have written like various self-care manuals. And I found it fascinating. And one of the books I'm now reading is by Katia Narane Phillips and her sister Nadia Narane. Katia is a wellness expert and a cook who's had several different cafes, including the Nectar Cafe, which is like a very cult delicious cafe. And Nadia is a like very well-known yoga teacher, and they've written a few books, and one of them was Self-Care Rituals for the Everyday. And I never read self-help books. And I was lying in the bath last night and I was like, these books are great.
Yeah.
Again, this is like Sainsbury's app, isn't it? But it said, you know, like all that stuff that I know but never do. So if you just have 5 minutes for yourself, why not give yourself like a hand massage? So I got out of the bath last night and I gave myself a face massage for 5 minutes.
Oh.
And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And then I've had some whole milk in my coffee and I really enjoyed it.
It's about putting it into your everyday routine.
I think I'm really working on myself at the moment and I'm finding it really fascinating.
I think that's great, particularly, well, for everyone, but particularly for new mums, I think, because so much of your
disorientation and
And also just so much of survival is that you have to just be thinking about the well-being of this thing, and maybe the well-being of you kind of can get lost in all that.
I think one of the hardest things to do if you are quite a kind of neurotic thinky person is to just focus on one thing. So the thing that I'm trying to do more than anything at the moment is to focus on one thing. So if other thoughts come into my head, but what are you doing tomorrow, and when have you organized, you know, your next dinner party, and have you done all these things? And I think, no, go away.
Yeah.
I'm busy thinking about an article I read, and I'm having a nice time thinking about an article I read. And that is really important, I think, isn't it?
That is such an important part of self-care, and also focusing on one activity and being really present in it. I think it's really good that you're discovering self-care. I'm actually having a bit of... You and I think, are going in opposite directions, because my column in this Sunday is me talking about how I'm worried about the culture of self-care.
I don't think it's without complications. And I think it does have the propensity to be navel-gazy, unrealistic. I think, as you know, I'm quite obsessed with neoliberalism and how I think a lot of what we're really, like, digging at the moment is not collective, like, choice feminism. You know, like, this makes me feel fucking great, so I'm going to do it. Cool, great. How's that, like, helping the rest of womankind? And that's fine if you want to do that. But don't call it feminism, or it's fine if you want to do that, but don't call it self-care.
Attach it to a doctrine,
So I have a problem with, like, doctrines and diktats and labels and all that guff. I don't necessarily, clearly,
have a problem with the activity.
With bettering yourself. Anyway, since we've been gone, Apple has added cream cheese to their emoji bagel after legions of complaints. Nick Clegg has been made head of policy and communications at Facebook.
Mad.
Trump critics, including Robert De Niro, were sent mail bombs. And Urban Outfitters released an influencer Halloween costume that consisted of a pair of leggings and a bra top. Now that's a high-low sandwich.
It is.
Lowbrow bread, emojis, Halloween costumes, with a highbrow political filling of Clegg and mail bombs.
I'm not sure about the cream cheese on the bagel emoji thing. I just think that's personal preference. When does it stop? What about those who are lactose intolerant?
Did you know that I have a bagel every single day?
For breakfast?
I do. I have clover on it.
Oh, nice.
And then I have Reese's, as in the chocolate brands, chocolate and peanut butter spread. It's divine. And I have it on a sesame bagel. So there's so much at play there, Dolly.
I never want you to change Pandora. Please delve into self-care and enjoy that. But just never change the chocolatey bagel.
But shall I also tell you what I sometimes do? Is a whole bagel can feel a bit much very early. So what I do is I have half my bagel with my peanut butter and chocolate spread mix. And then at lunch I have the other half. And I put some Gruyere on it. Pop it in the microwave for 20 seconds. Take out and then put pickle on it. So that's another...
But presumably that you haven't put the chocolate on that one.
No, I keep it in the toaster and then I just give it a quick blitz to warm it, just to, you know, frisson.
Yeah.
And then the Gruyere and then the pickle. So I have half my bagel for breakfast and half my bagel for lunch.
Thrifty.
No but, cream cheese there.
But then, Matt, do you accompany it with a salad or something?
No, the vegetables come later in the day.
Because I'm worried that's not going to sustain you, I must say.
Well, yeah, you're right. I'm working on it. My favourite thing I learnt this week was via my husband. And that is, I think he obviously saw a meme, that when you sneeze and fart at the same time, it's the human body taking a screenshot.
That's such an Ollie joke.
I think it's amazing.
It's so good.
It's very disorientating. And sometimes God, I see Zadie do it and I think, you poor love, I know that was overwhelming.
It is literally even kind of the sound.
Yeah, exactly. It's good that, isn't it?
Charlie's agreeing furiously.
So from human screenshots to ye old mailbag. What was in there, Dolly?
We've had some great emails from our listeners about our discussion of Generation Z and how they were drinking less. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and experiences. This one was from Alessandra. I've had a few conversations with friends this week about how we are considered generation sensible. We're all 20, 21. I'm a student at Warwick Uni and there does feel like such a pressure to be going so far above and beyond in extracurricular things, especially as an arts / humanities student, and drinking just makes getting everything done so much harder. There seems to be such a sense of, well, if I'm paying $9,000 a year for this degree, I actually want to be able to make it to my morning lectures and not feel shit. A lot of societies are now going to extra lengths to provide non-drinking social events, and a friend on my course who doesn't drink for religious reasons now goes to so many more socials because she feels much more included, which is great. Also, thanks to Pandora for the French chill recommendation. I've had it on this afternoon while writing coursework, and it's such a vibe.
People are loving the French chill.
They loved the French chill.
That's a really interesting point that I hadn't thought about and that didn't come up in our interviews with Scarlett and Charlie, is that totally makes sense, is that tuition fees are fucking expensive now that it's actually a bit gross, isn't it? Because I think that both of us would probably have had a slightly different university experience if our tuition
had
fees...
Had pressure.
Yeah. It, rather than just like rolling up hung over all the time. I mean, we still such an investment.
We still had to pay, obviously, but it was a fraction of $9,000 a year.
It was a third, wasn't it?
Yeah. We also got an email from Lois Paisley about a news story I find genuinely fascinating, and I'd love to follow up with a piece on it, actually. Doctors in the Shetland Islands can now prescribe nature. It is believed to be the first programme of its kind in the UK. Lois said, this is one for Dolly's obsession with the Highlands. And she's right. Long-time listeners might remember I visited Orkney and totally fell in love. And the Shetlands are islands just north of Orkney. The article states that the programme includes a leaflet for patients that reads, in February, you can make a wind sock from a hoop and material to appreciate the speed of the wind. In March, you can make beach art from natural materials or borrow a dog and take it for a walk. In April, you can touch the sea and make a bug hotel. I used to love doing that. In May, you can bury your face in the grass. In July, you can pick two different kinds of grass and really look at them. Pandora, stop laughing. In August, you can summon a worm out of the ground without digging or using water. In September, you can... Oh, Pandora's literally having a meltdown. In September, you can help clean the beach and prepare a meal outdoors. In October, you can appreciate a cloud. Pandora, pull it together. You can talk to a pony in November, feed the birds in your garden in December, and do so much more. That's what I should have done last week.
But Dolly, the thing that I love about this is you don't need to wait till May to bury your face in the grass, and I think you could choose to summon a worm out of the ground in any month of the year. And also, if you want to appreciate a cloud, girlfriend, you go appreciate a cloud.
No, you have to wait for the designated.
It's actually October, so just get out there. Oh my God, that was fantastic.
But I love that because it is, I am a massive believer,
obviously, of talking to ponies.
Of talking to ponies and staring at clouds and summoning worms for mental health. Truly, I think the power of nature is so healing, and I think it's great that that's now being
I think for me the most potent one there is a wind sock to appreciate the speed.
All right.
Sounds quite sexual, a wind sock.
Let's hear the final email. I knew you weren't going to take that one seriously. Let's hear the final email.
Oh, thanks for that. Love that. Speaking of nature, we got a very touching email involving a sweet pair of sea turtles. This is from Daisy. My first solo holiday, I was filled with trepidation and fear of essentially the unknown. In a hostel, I overheard a girl, Rose, recommending everything I know about love to another girl, and I immediately saw my opportunity and seized it, agreeing with Rose that this other girl should immediately read Dolly's book. Next thing I knew, Rosie and I were discussing our favourite Hilo episodes and also recommending it to everyone in the hostel. Without having listened to the Hilo, I'm not sure the trip would have been quite the same. So when we went to the turtle conservation, we had the amazing opportunity to release sea turtles. Rose and I decided that without the Hilo, we would not have met. So in your honour, we named our two sea turtles Dolly and Pandora. God, we've got so many animals named after us now. We've got a menagerie, DP menagerie. We got to take them to the sea and watch as they embarked on the new chapter of their lives. I've actually watched sea turtles hatch in Jamaica, and I helped them race to the sea. Did you know that, Dolly?
Yeah, I remember, because it was...
So I spent my 30th birthday.
Yeah, I remember being so jealous, and it was also the first time that the Hilo went to number two in the charts, because I remember you messaged me being like, sea turtles and number two, couldn't be happier. So thank you for that, and thank you for the picture of the very sweet little sea turtles, which of course we will tweet. What have you been enjoying this week, Panda?
Read lots of books, as usual. In fact, I did a big Instagram post last week on all the books I've been enjoying since the last time I did a books post from the summer, and I think I'll probably keep trying to do one of those every 6 weeks. In the last week, I've read some great books. The Keeper, which is the second novel by Graham Norton.
Oh, apparently
the very same Graham Norton. It's lovely. Gentle Irish tale. My mum's going to love it. It's had really good reviews. It's really, really lovely. It's quite sad. It's very moving. I also read Late in the Day by Tessa Hadley. 7 Days of Us by Sunday Times Style alumni Francesca Hornack. And Tuesdays with Maury by Mitch Albom, which appears to be a super cult book by the Instagram responses, including one that said that they thought I was better than that. Far too soppy for me. And I wanted to reply, but couldn't be bothered being like, I'm definitely not better than that.
But also how
I'm really soppy.
How snooty.
Really snooty. But you in particular, Dolly, will love Late in the Day by Tessa Hadley and 7 Days of Us by Francesca Hornack. They are both the quintessential Meg Wolitzer domestic novel in the most elevated sense. They're both excellently insightful on family dynamics and, in Tessa Hadley's case, the intricacies and hypocrisies of close friendship. Some journalism I've loved since the last show. Lots of journalists wrote about camp following the announcement that the Met Gala's 2019 theme was to be camp.
Oh,
my favourite was Charlie Porter for the Financial Times, who broke down what is and isn't camp.
Do they mean camp in that sense?
In the kind of political, social, historical... I can't wait to see it bastardised by the celebrities.
Because that feels...
Do you remember they did Catholicism this year?
Yeah, well, I was about to say that feels near to the knuckle, but then I suppose when you think about
there is always Catholicism, near to the knuckle, yeah. So they take... I suppose social, historical, or artistic movements normally related to an exhibition that the Met's curator has done. So I'm sure there's an exhibition attached to this. Yeah, my favourite was Charlie Porter writing for Financial Times about what is and isn't camp. Twitter is definitely not camp because it is inherently desperate. Instagram is not camp, but it can be a vehicle for camp. But dog posts are always camp because humans have fetishized dogs to become manifestations of their repressed camp instincts. Middle-aged users of Instagram are often camp without realizing it, especially when they try to take selfies. Indeed, being middle-aged is in itself quite camp because middle-age is a failed attempt at seriousness. Sally Hughes wrote a piece for The Pool in light of Meghan Markle's rumoured decision to cut out her family, a piece which I'm still thinking about her own decision to deliberately estrange herself from family members. People, even the nicer ones, are so horrified by an adult child's decision to sever ties with their parents or take an extended break, but they immediately tell you what they think you don't already, very painfully, know. It's so sad. Yes, it is. Is anything that bad that can't be fixed? Yes, it would appear there is. You'll be heartbroken when he's dead. Of course. Oh, I love my parents. Me too. But not at my own life's expense. I've heard them all. She then goes on to say, family estrangement is, in my fairly considerable personal experience, very rarely a grudge. It's not about punishing someone or teaching them a lesson or refusing to back down. And it's certainly not about needing to win. Far from it. It is a loss so huge to everyone concerned that it feels much like a death. It's neither flippant nor entered into lightly. More often than not, estrangement is a last resort. a painful and measured decision to remove yourself from your daily life behaviours and people that consistently make you feel unhappy, chaotic and upset.
What an amazing piece, because actually I think that's something perhaps...
It's a really hard point of view.
Yeah, and
as well.
Perhaps that's something we all, I'm thinking about myself, have been insensitive to in the past.
We both come from very
stable,
happy, lucky families.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that if you come from that, that you think about that, that you understand that. I loved her debunking the cliched responses to the news that she has estranged herself from the parent.
And that it's a collective grief for everyone.
Yeah.
How unbelievably tragic
and that it's
and
not
sad
about love,
for everyone.
And
yeah,
it's not
exactly.
about mourning or wanting them dead or being happy, being happy when they are. Yeah, thought that was a really interesting, important, moving read.
Yeah.
Also a very moving and important read this week. New York Magazine's cover story for this week and next week, the magazine comes out every 2 weeks, is a brilliant and stunning series of interviews with 27 survivors of high school shootings in America over the last half century.
Oh my gosh.
There have been over 70 high school shootings this year alone. Just this week, a student was shot dead at a school in North Carolina by a classmate, and there was not a high school shooting, but there was a shooting in a Pittsburgh synagogue where 11 people were killed. The piece has been rightly lauded. It's fascinating and so beautifully shot by Michael Avedon. The cover features a truly stunning black and white picture of a survivor from the Parkland, Florida shooting in February of this year, Anthony Borge, who was shot five times and now wears a colostomy bag, and he's been credited with saving the lives of over 20 people. Avedon travelled the country from Parkland to Columbine, taking photos of half a century of school shooting victims. The piece is written by Jared Sewell and Amelia Schonbeck, and the introduction offers such pause for thought. One of the first recorded American school shootings took place in 1840, they write, which is an interesting fact, but the first high school shooting that truly lodged itself in our consciousness was Columbine in 1999, when two students wearing trench coats fatally shot 13 of their classmates. It took 45 minutes for a SWAT team to go in. As the AP would note, those officers had never trained for what they found. No hostages, no demands, just killing. Link in the show notes, as usual. Read, read, read. And my last recommendation for this week's episode is an episode of The Food Chain, which is a BBC World Service podcast presented by Emily Thomas. And the episode that I listened to that I found really interesting was on why eating disorders are not a rich white woman's problem. The podcast discusses how eating disorders are dismissed and looked down upon in the black community, particularly in Africa. It's seen as a rejection of the archetypal black body type, striving to be Western and skinny, and not seen as a mental disorder, that's seen as something superficial and vacuous. I found it incredibly interesting, and I'm going to insert a clip here.
One study found doctors are less likely to diagnose a fictional case study character with an eating disorder if she's black, rather than Caucasian or Hispanic. That's worrying because there's some evidence that in the US, bulimia may actually occur at higher rates in black than white populations. The National Eating Disorders Association says that black women may be more vulnerable to eating disorders because of environmental stress such as abuse, racism, and poverty.
You know, I always heard things like, well, you know, black women don't have eating disorders. Black women are incredibly comfortable with being large. I just felt like I was failing all the way around, failing at being the archetype strong black woman.
What about you, Dol? What have you been enjoying?
I've listened to some great podcast episodes. I listened to Busy Phillips, who was on Marc Maron's WTF.
Did you read her interview with Sophie Hayward as well?
No, I haven't. If you've just reminded me, I'm going to read that on
yeah,
the way
you'll
home.
Like that.
I really like her. I think she's so, so great. It's such an interesting conversation. I must read her book, actually, as well, which I've heard really good things about, which is on my bedside table. And she was talking about the book in the interview, and it sounds like a very bravely and truthfully approached memoir.
I wish we could have got her on to the
I know.
Pilot. She follows me on Instagram.
Does she?
She wrote underneath a picture, oh, my God, like, I love this dress or something. And I think I replied... If I didn't, I wanted to. All in capitals. Oh my God, I love you. Just like really cool.
Oh my God, DM Busy Phillips. Do it now, live on air. I love her. And I think she's very interesting actually about talking.
Really local radio station.
She's very interesting talking about her transition from big, big American TV star over to kind of Instagram star. She's very honest about it.
About,
she's
being,
like,
about being an influencer.
Yeah.
She talks about that with Sophie Hayward.
And she's like, well, I got a book deal and a TV show. She's got a new chat show coming out that I think will be brilliant. She seems really, really funny. She talks about the challenges of parenthood in a very honest and quite cutting, but very funny way. And she talks in quite granular detail about the anxiety that's plagued her whole life. And also, you can tell in the interview that Marc Maron really likes her, which is quite rare in those interviews. You never really get that vibe when he's having those chats, unless it's like a huge star like Paul McCartney. You never get the vibe that he really wants to impress them or that he feels like they're on the same wavelength. But I really felt that in the interview with Busy Phillips. So that's a great chat to listen to.
She's also got the best name ever.
I know. I just think she's gorgeous. Do you know what? Another thing she talks about as well is in a way that's really devastating. And I think she's written about it in her memoir as well, is about how she, straight after she gave birth to one of her children, she was in dire straits financially and she really needed like a TV job, like an acting gig. And she got one. And she was said to the casting producers that she was, you know, bigger than her normal weight because she'd just given birth. Mm-hmm. But she'd worked out a way that she thinks that her losing weight throughout the show would have made sense with her character, because her character was like an actress who was emerging. And I think she was, in a preliminary sense, given the job, and then it was taken away from her, and it was because of her weight. She was specifically told it was because her agent apparently had to ring her and say, it didn't go our way, was the way that she said it, and it's because you're too big.
Oh, Christ alive.
And can you imagine, like, the livelihood of your family resting on the circumference of your waist? I mean, it's so unthinkable. It's so stressful to think of it. But anyway, yeah, so she talks about that in a way that must not be hugely comfortable to talk, you know, or enjoyable to talk about. So I take my hat off to her for being honest about that. Another great WTF episode is Richard E. Grant's, which went out last week, I think. Every time I listen to a podcast episode with Richard E. Grant, I become more and more convinced that he might be one of the only truly 100% decent celebrity actors
around.
Along
with Bill Nighy.
Bill Nighy. Oh my God, speaking of which, it's a bit of a diversion, but there's a film that's coming out that India told me about, and when she described it, I was like, this is what Pandora thinks my whole personal brand is. And it's like Bill Nighy competing in a Scrabble competition. I was like, that's what Pandora thinks that my...
Quite riveted they got that film greenlit.
I know. Anyway, it looks really, really good. Sorry, that was a quick diversion. Back to Richard E. Grant. He's just so eccentric in such an unlaboured, kind of authentic way. And he's so naturally curious. You really get that sense from him. Every time I hear him do an interview, he turns the questions round to the interviewer. Not in a manipulative way. He just is so engaged mm-hmm. and interested in other people's stories. He did it with my friend Roisin Ingle on her podcast. Roisin's an Irish columnist. And that's another fantastic conversation, actually. Her podcast is called Roisin Meets. In both those conversations, he talks about the fact he's allergic to alcohol, which I find quite funny because it's so at odds with the withnail persona that I think so many of us associate him with.
Has he had a lifetime of people being like, come to the pub,
yeah,
here's a shot on me?
Well, Marc Maron was like, I can't believe that you came in here looking like so clean and so well put together. I thought you'd stumble in here like a sort of Richard Burton. And Richard E. Grant was like, you know, I don't drink or smoke.
It's quite funny as well, because that's such a like ridiculous... It's the idea that you are... No, but it's the idea that you are your character, and that character was what, like 40
years ago? Yeah, yeah. I also think with an American guy thinking about that sort of old school, classically trained actor.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's a really great chat. He talks about his extraordinary childhood. He had an alcoholic father who tried to shoot him when he was a kid,
Jesus.
When he tried to throw away a bottle of his booze. He talks about waking up in a car when he was a child to find his mother having sex with his dad's best friend on the bonnet.
God.
He talks about growing up in Swaziland, which is one of the smallest countries in Africa, and why Swaziland for him will always be the landscape that is home to him. He's one of those people that I could just listen to his stories and his insights on the world and humanity forever. And I have his memoir again on the bedside table that I keep meaning to read, which is called With Nails.
I see what they did there. When did that come out? Is it a new one?
No, it's an old one, but it's meant to be a sort of definitive memoir. And when I listen to those interviews, I can see why. So highly recommend that. Dr. Buckles is back, and this week his episode is with his old mate Louis Theroux, which are always the best episodes in my opinion.
Yeah, they've done quite a few now, haven't they?
This one is decidedly less silly than the last ones, although I did play Pandora and Charlie a clip at the very end of the interview that is worth listening to, even though it's very puerile. There are some funny moments, but it's kind of more sombre. It's more on the subject matters that are covered in Louis Theroux's upcoming TV series, which include documentaries about polyamory, babies being put up for adoption, and a new law in California regarding euthanasia, which leads on to quite a profound conversation about the death of Adam's father that I found quite philosophical, actually. He talks about what to do with the diaries of the dead, which I think is a very interesting ethical grey mm-hmm. area. And they also talk about the two memoirs that they're both writing, and needless to say, I will be reading both. But the serious bit is not what I'm going to put in here. The clip that I'm going to insert is Adam Buxton and Louis Theroux talking about Oprah Winfrey's morning routine. They're reading aloud Oprah Winfrey's supposed morning routine.
This morning, when I hit the blackout shades just after 7, the light was casting its golden glow over the green lawn, with the clouds and ocean in the distance. I watched 3 geese fly over the backyard and land in the pond. I don't know if that happens every morning.
I was going to say, this isn't her routine.
Well,
unless she's got a guy who's in charge with releasing 3 geese every morning.
This is typical Oprah. This is her talking in Bazaar magazine, I think. And I think she does have a guy who releases 3 geese every morning that fly over the backyard and land in the pond.
Finally, I would like to recommend a book called My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Moshfegh. It is a novel set in pre-9/11 Manhattan and is told in the first person by a nameless young woman who ostensibly has everything on paper. She's blonde, she's beautiful, she has an East Side apartment, she's inherited a lot of money, but she's also lost both of her parents in traumatic circumstances and has been in an on-off relationship with, I think, the absolute worst character I've ever read in a book. I don't think I've ever had such a human gut reaction of hatred to a person who lives on a page quite like I had to this man, which is a testament to how good her writing is. The protagonist decides to retreat from the world by taking a year out of living, and a sort of wacko nutjob therapist, who is, on the other hand, one of the funniest characters I've ever met in the pages of a book, prescribes her an ever-changing and extreme cocktail of drugs to basically put her to sleep for a year with some brief pauses for washing and eating. It's not a light book. It's very, very darkly funny, but I found it quite a grim reading experience. But I found it increasingly profound in its overarching metaphor, which was about a kind of capitalist malaise. And while the personal story was so compelling to me and became more and more of a page turner, I think the story was also such an interesting commentary on the outside landscape of the time, about the kind of end of an era, particularly in Clinton's America, which was about prosperity and decadence and a relative kind of ease of life. I absolutely adored it, and it comes highly recommended from me.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This week, I received a press release that tickled me so much and got me thinking about all the nostalgic and archival fashions I love that I immediately sent it to Dolly. According to a new survey by European fashion retailer Peter Hahn, no, me neither, the miniskirt has topped a list of the most iconic female fashion items of the last 50 years. Do you think the miniskirt deserves to be number one, doll?
Personally, I do, because I would say it's my most loved and worn item since adolescence. But generally, I know it's not universally loved and it's not generically worn by all women. I'm actually often told that my skirt is too short. I nearly didn't go on stage in the dress I wore on Sunday, actually, because my hemline was so short.
I love miniskirts, but I don't know if it's the friendliest item to have been awarded number one. I know a lot of women who would never wear one, but perhaps iconic is not the same as most women feel good in it. Maybe that's a problem.
Yeah, I think that that's the big difference. And I think actually it's more to do with what the miniskirt represents historically.
Yeah.
And it is the garment that people often associate with women's sexual liberation in the 60s, which I know that period of time is often kind of truncated and glossed over and romanticised when we talk about it retrospectively. When you think that that was the decade that the pill was distributed, there's no denying that the miniskirt suddenly has a slightly iconic edge, I think.
Number two on the list are the classic Levi's 501. Number three, Doc Martens. And number four is the denim jacket. I adore all of those, actually.
I'm desperate to find a pair of Levi's 501s. Sticklers from previous episodes after the spending ban is finished.
Because it's so hard to find your perfect pair
of
Levi's.
I've tried, and so they're just so good on me.
Redone is really good. They're very expensive, though. And
do you have new pairs of them rather than vintage?
No, they're all reworked.
Ah.
Because here's the thing with the 501 and a lot of kind of iconic jeans from like the 80s and 90s is the brilliant thing about trousers now and jeans is that the cut is so much more kind of high tech and
comfy.
And also flattering.
Yeah.
Levi 501s aren't particularly flattering.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they don't. It's, you know, they don't necessarily make you. They make people look like they've got a great bum, but they don't necessarily, they can be quite gunty. They can dig into your stomach. They don't necessarily make your legs look great. And that's the thing I think about a lot of our fashion is so much more technical now. If you think how much the way that trousers are cut, that's why I often don't buy vintage trousers. So I think the key with the 501s is getting, for a lot of the time, getting jeans tailored.
Right.
It's why a lot of high street jeans are actually like really, really flattering because they are made to kind of
flatter
what's considered like a modern
shape. Yeah.
Exactly. So they're hard to find.
I'm still determined to find. I wear them a lot. Yeah, I love the wedgies. You told me to buy the wedgies.
The 505s, I think, might be better than the 501s.
Oh, what's the difference?
I think it's a slightly, maybe it's a slightly narrower trouser leg.
Yeah, maybe
go
that
do
works.
Your research.
I will go
go into Levi's.
You told me to get wedgies because I've got an absolutely non-existent flat pancake square bum. And
yeah, the wedgies are good.
The wedgies like give me a bit of a butt, but the problem is that the hem's so short on them. So I want one with like a longer hem.
34 inches leg.
Yeah, I'm just like 350 million inches, yeah. But anyway, I'll go do my research. I'm also so, so glad that Doc Martens made the cut. They
loved
were my favourite shoes when I was a teenager. And I always love seeing women in a pair of DMs. I think they are truly iconic. And a denim jacket, I must say, I think looks good on everyone. I actually love boys in denim jackets as well. And Nigella Lawson, when you watch the old episode of Nigella Bites, which I do on YouTube nearly every time I'm hungover, she's always in a little fitted indigo denim jacket, which I know is very early noughties, but I think it's just so stylish.
Others on the list, skinny jeans, bell bottoms, pencil skirts and knee-high boots all made it into the top 10 iconic items list. Do they mean flares? Bell bottoms feel quite, it's quite extreme.
Yeah.
It's quite a hard sell, the bell.
I think all of those actually are quite a hard sell. Other than my beloved knee-high boot. I think skinny jeans, the sort of indie band kind with the proper drain pipe ankles, are so, so hard to wear, no matter what your shape. Pencil skirts are just horribly uncomfortable. And I love a flared jean. But bell bottoms feel a little bit Camden Market even for me, I have to say. I had a pair from Miss 60 when I was a teenager. that I used to wear with big buffalo trainers. And my mum said that when I would go out stomping around in the rain on my own, which unsurprisingly was quite a lot when I was a teenager, she could see the rain being like soaked up by the hem of the bell bottom all the way up to the knee. Isn't that disgusting?
How long were these jeans if on you? They were going beyond the buffalo.
I know, I know.
God, it was a phenomenon, Miss Sixty. I don't really know what happened to it since. I had some flares that were like very tight and then quite bell-bottomy. Unbelievably low rise.
Oh, with always
poppers up the side from Miss 60 that you could undo all the way to the hip.
Oh, I remember those.
With a flamboyant rip. It was very Christina Aguilera. And actually, Christina Aguilera was such a pertinent bit of early noughties fashion history, wasn't
yeah.
she? The chaps.
Yeah. Oh my God, the leather chaps.
The chaps. The study of 2,000 people also revealed that half of women over the age of 50 believe that they are still fashionable. Perish the thought. How verily dare they?
I actually think women only get more fashionable over 50. I think the more time you spend getting dressed, this is my experience, the more time you spend getting dressed, the bolder you become with your choices and the better you know your own style and colouring and figure.
I love, in all of these surveys, 50 is such a watermark age.
So like depressing.
At 49, you're like, not that sure about your fashion choices. And then 50, it's slightly like when you talk about 30 and you do talk about it like it's... this moving juggernaut, this like milk cart that you have to hop on and start giving out bottles of milk to everyone else younger. I think you'll agree with this one. The majority of women in the survey thought the 60s was the best decade for fashion, followed by the 70s and then the 50s.
I think that's entirely accurate, although I do have a soft spot for a 30s tea dress. Mm. And increasingly, thanks to Alessandra Rich, I'm finally starting to see the appeal of the 80s with polka dots and big velvet Alice bands and gaudy gold costume jewellery. For years, I absolutely loathed any kind of sartorially inspired 80s thing.
Well, you can keep your velvet Alice bands, but I agree, I love a lot of the 80s. But I think that might be because we're actually having high 80s renaissance right now. Cycling shorts, tweedy blazers with Levi's, button-down shirts, pearls, shoulder pads, embellished velvet, sweetie wrapper, shiny shirts and dresses.
I love it.
Although we're actually having a bit of everything right now, according to the chaos theory, which states that every single decade now influences our current sartorial parlance. We're sort of like post-epoch.
Yeah.
So we've got a bit of the 60s, a bit of the 70s, a bit of the 80s, 90s, noughties. And I think that kind of resonates. I think you can pick and choose a bit now. The only thing that makes me, well, doubt the veracity of this survey is that Stonewash jeans were number 11 and the boob tube was at number 25.
The boob tube?
And the rah-rah skirt was at number 32. When I was 14, I wore a black rah-rah skirt with a... Do you remember those Toby Pimlico tops that said, I will not kiss the boys, I will not?
Yeah.
So I had an orange camisole. I think it must have been a copycat one from Camden, actually. An orange camisole that said, I will not kiss the boys, I will not kiss the boys. And I wore that with my black rah-rah skirt and then hot pink leg...
Oh, yeah, I used to wear those.
Leg warmers.
Yeah.
Teamed with a low sling back rainbow striped mule from Office. And I remember... and I remember I snogged a boy. And after we snogged, he said, and can you imagine, I mean, I was 15, so it wasn't an issue, but can you imagine more of a boner killer than this line? It was, we snogged and it was time for pick up. And he said, Mummy doesn't like your leg warmers.
Oh my God.
So that's my story about the rah-rah skirt.
I had one of those t-shirt. Who designed them? Toby
Pimlico.
I had one of them, and I can't believe I'm going to tell you this because you will never let me live
CJ
it down.
Is loving this trip down memory lane, by the way.
I snuffled the slogan that was on mine, bearing in mind that I was North London's longest reigning virgin.
I thought you meant to say longest, as in you were like physically
and that
longest,
as well.
Longest, just their longest virgin.
Just like lumbering virgin. The t-shirt said, model turned actress. I don't think even I believed it.
Part of me absolutely... But what I loved about these t-shirts is all the girls... Actually quite inappropriate when you think about them. All the teenage girls wearing them, it's like, I will not kiss the boys. Like, I didn't really have boys queuing up to kiss me. It wasn't like I was like walking into a room and being like, darling, I can't.
Yeah.
And we were all wearing these like really saucy t-shirts, which implied that we had like the opportunity that we didn't.
Yeah. But also that sort of fake, coy flirtation. It's just so inappropriate for a child.
Faux knowingness.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit Geordie Shore, but also in North London, I sometimes see like a 45-year-old man walking down the street. And my favourite one I saw recently was a middle-aged man wearing a T-shirt that said influencer.
Oh my God, that's so funny. My brother bought one when he was like 11 from Camden Market that said nobody.
Common theme, Camden, isn't it?
Camden Punky Market, Fish. You can still get those T-shirts there.
You still
there.
Get Punky Fish though?
I don't know if Punky Fish is still going, actually.
With a little fishy zipper.
With all the UFO trousers, with all the flappy bits coming off. And then my brother's one that he bought, and my mum used to despair when he would wear it to like church or whatever, was nobody knows I'm a lesbian. Actually, like to know who else, if anyone still has their Camden slogan T-shirt,
send us a picture.
Please send us a picture.
The cricket jumper was at number 48, whilst the bandage dress was at number 50.
This is quite random, this list.
Somewhere in there was the Chanel suit spelt channel. Do you think anything was missing?
I think maybe the white trouser suit.
Ooh, that's a bold call.
Which, sadly, I've never dared to do it, although I have contemplated it in my time. I've always wanted to channel that kind of Bianca Jagger vibe, but I'm worried I'll miss the mark and end up as Liberty X.
It's not a particularly fashion-forward survey, I grant you. May I direct you to the boob tube and the rah-rah skirt? Although that's no bad thing in my book. However, I do think the hoodie should have made it on, and possibly leggings. Not because I love them. Though, unusually, I am actually wearing them today with socks and sandals for ultimate North London middle-class mum points. But because I think high-performance leggings have changed women's lives in a social and health sense. I genuinely think that they empower more women to go to the gym now, as the gear is so much better.
Yeah. I also don't think poor old Pandora has seen me at a high-low record not wearing trainers and leggings for the best part of a year.
Got a lot of very jaunty leggings.
I have such a great selection of...
Are you wearing the squiggles today?
No, I'm wearing the Sweaty Betty Japanese art leggings.
Ooh.
You've seen a lot of my camel toes this
art.
Year.
Yeah, I actually, you've got a really good one right now. And it's bisected up the middle with a hem. What is it? Like
Charlie.
A seam. It cleaves right up.
Look at what Charlie's doing. He's literally staring at the ceiling.
Well, so he doesn't have to look at your fucking vagina. That's all you can see in this room.
Anyway.
All you can see.
Back to the miniskirt, Pandora. I'd like a final fact, please.
I thought we'd end on some fashion trivia. On the 30th of October 1965, this very same day that we are recording, 53 years previous, model Jean Shrimpton caused a sensation by wearing a miniskirt dress to the... or a mini dress, to the Melbourne Cup in Australia. Doesn't she look fabulous?
She looks gorgeous, but I mean, I would almost class that as a midi.
It's not even short.
No.
It's just above knee length. But for the time, it was positively pussy skimming.
A couple of episodes ago, we talked about Philip Green demanding that a pop-up stall for Feminists Don't Wear Pink, an essay collection curated by Scarlett Curtis, be dismantled in the flagship branch of Topshop in Oxford Circus. This week, we're talking about him again, for very different reasons. He has found himself at the centre of an alleged scandal that once again has brought into question the ethical implications of injunctions and NDAs.
The Daily Telegraph reported last week that Philip Green, the chairman of the Arcadia Group, a retail company that includes Topshop, Topman, Wallace, Evans, Burton, Miss Selfridge and Dorothy Perkins, had been granted an injunction preventing the Telegraph from naming him. The paper said interviews with five members of staff revealed that victims had been paid substantial sums in return for legal commitments not to discuss their alleged experiences.
Here's where it gets a bit complicated. Although the press was gagged from naming him, MPs and peers have parliamentary privilege, which is a legal immunity over statements made in the House of Commons or Lords.
So does that mean, Dol, that they can say stuff even if it's behind an injunction? They have the immunity to say it.
Yes, exactly. So Labour peer Lord Hayne identified the Topshop boss in the House of Lords on Thursday, saying he felt it was his duty to do so because it was in the public interest. The Telegraph and the media at large then claimed they were entitled to report Lord Hayne's statement in Parliament. Philip Green has claimed that Philip Hayne was not transparent about his financial links to the law firm that represented the Daily Telegraph during the injunction. At the moment, it feels like the conversation is just so much about what can and cannot be said legally rather than the specifics of the allegations themselves. But I'm sure that that is to come.
I think that's what makes the case really interesting, though, is it is making us kind of look into the legalese around how things are made public and not. There's also a lot of Phillips in this story, that's an observation. Since then, on Friday the 26th of October, The Guardian alleged, thanks to an anonymous Arcadia insider coming forward, that there were seven suspected settlements, with some of them being seven figures. The source alleged that Green's behaviour included walking into meetings and giving women lingering hugs, asking them if they were naughty girls and needed their bottoms slapped, creeping up behind them in the corridors to make them jump before comforting them with a hug, telling women they were overweight and needed to diet, and flying into expletive-laden rages.
Philip Green spoke to the Mail on Sunday this past weekend and dismissed any allegations as some banter, which has never been offensive. Speaking from a spa in Arizona, which is a detail I very much relished, he said, "I'm very, very, very upset. I'm being used as target practice when there is zero evidence that anyone has turned up with. It's injuring my business, all the people potentially working in the business, and it's injuring me and my family." He went on to say, "This whole thing is disgusting. This has got nothing to do with any sexual misconduct. It's nonsense. This cannot be right, knocking on people's doors, harassing people, trying to make them say something that's not true." In regards to the claims of racism aboard his super yacht, he explained, "My family's longest serving Filipino employee, who brings many others to work for us, has been with us for 28 years. The family still employs many Filipinos, and anyone who's telling you there is an issue with Filipinos is just making trouble."
That's such a irrelevant statement, because just because you employ someone doesn't mean that you aren't racist or racially abuse them. Like, having someone serving you doesn't mean that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
if anything, it quite often probably was the other way around, because it's about keeping a certain status. And I'm not knocking. Do you know what I mean? I think it's possible to employ someone Filipino, and that doesn't mean that you see yourself as
other. No, of course, I do think it's an irrelevant statement.
It's completely irrelevant statement. You might have employed them for 28 years. It doesn't mean you haven't been a dickhead in that time. Rachel Clark, an author and doctor, made me laugh with this tweet, which is trending today. "Which of us hasn't indulged in some harmless banter at work, then made seven-figure payouts to silence our colleagues?"
Well, quite. And actually, Charlie has regularly pulled stunts like that. And we've had to settle, you know, six, seven-figure sums outside of this very room.
I just love that tweet from Rachel Clark. Like, it was almost like sort of normalcy in business. But that's the thing. I think he thinks it's normal in business. Yeah. I think it probably is normal in business.
And it's not, Charlie. Times have changed. You've really got to change with them.
No, we're joking. CJ is a model colleague. It's Dolly. I'm actually, you know, if I had to trade one of them, it's her. Philip Green warned reporters that things would get horribly, horribly ugly for the Telegraph if it didn't halt its ongoing investigation. He said to a reporter, "I'm going to proposition you, actually. I'm going to turn gay in a minute."
That's how it happens, isn't it? You just turn gay in a single minute in order to assault a reporter trying to do his job and report on your gross behaviour. Also, I love the idea that threatening to turn gay and proposition someone is, in fact, a smart way to prove to the national press that you are a responsible, appropriate, ethical and fair employer.
Talk about digging yourself into an even larger hole. He best be careful. I've heard that is how it happens. I was quite resistant to talk about this topic at first. We both, if I'm honest, really wanted a week of the high-low where we don't have to talk about alleged sexual abuse or harassment, where we can talk for the whole episode about miniskirts. I mean, what a dream of a witter that would be. But so many people wanted us to talk about it, and we do feel compelled when something like this happens, as we have in the past, that we kind of have to talk about it, because that's the power that we all have right now, is to be having these discussions. And actually, we thought it said a lot about where we are right now as well with NDAs and injunctions. They've become such a part of modern life. So many celebrities have them. Who gets them? Why do they get upheld? And what's the difference between an injunction and an NDA? That's what we were interested in.
So Pandora referred to the Library of Google.
I did, although I'd like to add, I did do quite a lot of comparing and contrasting of terms to try and put it into the simplest of definitions, so thank you very much. So here's the difference as I see it. An injunction is an umbrella term for a court order that compels a party to do or refrain from specific acts. It might take the form of a non-molestation act, so if you're a victim of domestic abuse, but no charges of a criminal offence have been made, i.e. you don't have a restraining order, then you can apply for an injunction. Or, as we so often hear about them now, injunctions take the form of silencing one party when settling, financially or otherwise, where giving monetary damages is not seen as sufficient. So if someone talks, you know, the damage can still be made. An NDA, on the other hand, is an agreement between two parties rather than something served or enforced by one party to the other. Although we saw in the Harvey Weinstein case with Anne Novary that NDAs can be forced upon a party through intimidation or if they don't have adequate legal strength. So it becomes, I think, slightly muddy from what I've read.
Theresa May has not commented explicitly about this case, but on the subject of NDAs, she said that some companies used the agreements unethically, and she said that non-disclosure agreements or NDAs should not silence whistleblowers, and also that the government would take action to make sure employees knew their rights.
I don't think she's really saying anything that anyone else hasn't been saying. Not groundbreaking. But they're 100% used unethically, and I think they probably have been for a long time. We don't necessarily hear much about business injunctions, but we hear a lot about celebrity injunctions. As journalists, we certainly do, obviously. We can't relay any of them here. 9 times out of 10, they really fuck me off because they protect some rich celebrity at someone else's expense, often the person who is telling the truth, all in the name of so-called public interest. I've had so many debates at dinner recently about what constitutes public interest.
What have the debates entailed?
Well, funnily enough, they've been about both Philip Green and another very famous individual who I have long had very vigorous and increasingly wine-fueled debates about. So my point of view is, and I'm using the example of cheating here, because very often that's how injunctions are granted to celebrities. And we know that because when the injunction fails, The Sun or some tabloid will print how they tried to seek an injunction and failed. I don't much care if a celebrity cheats on their wife or husband. I mean, I wish they didn't, but
I really don't care.
I don't think it's hugely our business.
No.
But if you are making a lot of money off a public persona that upholds you as a family man with certain values, then that is problematic to me, because you're selling a lie, and that's morally bankrupt. And it's also presenting a false idealism of marriage and how easy it is to stay in a lasting monogamous relationship.
So you're saying that pushes a lie, a sort of insidious lie.
I think it's an ethical wrong, and that's why I think it's in the public interest. I don't think you get to be a celebrity, act like the cat who got the cream, or to continue my metaphor, the pussy, and then go, no, don't tell anyone. I don't want to break up my family, or more importantly, lose my many, many global family-friendly endorsements. Well, you should have thought of that before, mate. That's why I think it's in the public interest.
I think this will sound like a very obvious point, but I think really breaking it down, fundamentally, the problem with financial settlements and NDAs in terms of public interest is that public interest cannot just be decided and edited by those in power with enormous amounts of money who can erase history to manage their reputation.
No, I think it should. I think public interest should be seen literally in kind of like societal ethics. Just does it further the benefit and the understanding and the mutual.
But the question is who decides that?
The judge. But they've been making the wrong decisions.
Yeah, but that's such a. It's so difficult to draw that boundary.
It's not objective, is it?
Yeah. And the problem, I think, not so much with injunctions, but from sort of settlements, out-of-court settlements, is that beyond ethics, I think it's just unfair. I think if erasing transgressions was available to everyone, then maybe I would be more on board with it. But it can't just be available to men in power, because it's a system that allows men to routinely abuse that power.
I mean, and to be fair, I don't think it's just men. I think there's probably plenty of rich women who have been, of course, in this example.
But I have to say, generically speaking, who has the most power and money and therefore the most resources to be able to censor history
you know, white men. What I find so interesting about this case is not Lord Hayne who enforced his immunity, but the gathering momentum, not least by Scarlett Curtis, that created an environment where for the first time people were publicly criticising Philip Green for reasons other than business. He's been criticised in a business sense for ages because of the disgusting way that he acted over BHS pensions and also all the tax loopholes he exploits by living in Monaco. As you mentioned recently, Dolly, the Sunday Times correspondent Oliver Shaw wrote a great eviscerating book about him that someone actually recommended to me, again, at dinner on Friday night. But no one had really questioned him, morally speaking, in places other than broadsheet op-eds or kind of like specific books, and certainly nothing had ever been revealed that I'd read about his sexual conduct, which is something that all megalomaniacs now face, having been put under this microscope. Perhaps that's the most successful part of Me Too, is that we have seen, sadly, it's not going to erase everyday sexism yet, and certainly there's been a lot of infighting between the campaigners of Me Too. It's not going to stop the Brett Kavanaughs of this world, but it can and will reveal in ways that hadn't previously been done so the morally and or sexually redundant and repugnant. And Philip Green has now segued into a business, from a business person into a person of pop culture interest.
There have been calls for Beyoncé to remove her clothing line from Topshop, and Sophie Wilkinson wrote a great piece for Grazia about why women associated with Philip Green shouldn't be held accountable for his actions. She writes, "The questioning of women for a man's alleged actions feels like a rotten power play that deserves its own analysis. True, Kate Moss has previously been a business partner of Green's, and her last Topshop collection was in 2014. Beyoncé's Ivy Park range was initially launched through Topshop, also in 2014. Perhaps if we're in the game of asking celebrities about their experiences with Green, it might be worth hitting up Nick Grimshaw, who also did a range with Topman in 2015. Should powerful men be able to shut women up? Should powerful publications be able to suggest women, to the exclusion of men, are accountable for men's actions simply by virtue of having hung out with them or even worked with them? The answer to both is a resounding simple no. Depicting women as either stupid or Machiavellian in taking sides of an allegedly disgraced man when the full story isn't out only seems to prop up the status quo that has seen nasty men long wield their power with impunity."
Always on the money is Soph. I actually think as well we'll see quite a different public reaction to how we have. I know it's not the same case before people say I'm conflating, but in media terms it has been compared to what happened with Harvey Weinstein and Me Too in America. And rather crassly, it has been called the British Me Too. I think we'll see people react very differently to how Donna Karan, who is still, I think, seen in a really kind of critical light for, in the early days, standing by Harvey Weinstein. I think anyone who, any women who publicly stood with him were really, really torn down. And that's very different, by the way, to having worked with them in the past. On that note, will you be boycotting Topshop? I don't know if truly, honestly, I will totally stop shopping there. I feel conflicted and embarrassed to admit that, and I'm sure I'll be criticised for it. And I do get that in shopping there I am, you know, effectively lining P. Green's pockets. But I want to be truthful and realistic. It's one of my favourite shops on the high street. It's one of the best stores on the high street. And whilst I definitely don't feel compelled to wander in there right now, I can't pretend that whatever happens, I won't ever shop there again. I can actually see a world, though, where people lie about where something is from or whisper, having done a furtive dash, Topshop, when they're asked where, you know, say their leopard print coat hails from.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think the question of whether to boycott Topshop is really the most pressing
right
now.
Neither do I, but don't you foresee that happening?
I've already seen women on Twitter encourage other women to stop shopping there, and I don't actually think that's hysterical. I do understand it, but realistically, I don't.
Do you think you would ever shop there again?
Probably, if I'm being totally honest.
I think it's important to be honest, because I think sometimes we say what we think we have to say to avoid criticism from others. And you are talking about, he does own half the high street.
I think we're in such early days of understanding how this is going to pan out. I think there are more pressing general national questions. Will Hutton wrote an opinion piece for The Guardian on how Philip Green and the way he runs his empire needs to be seen as an example of how business needs to change. Mm-hmm. He writes, British capitalism needs a root and branch makeover. We need more firms committed to creating value over time, animated by a purpose. Firms that want to be great places to work, to serve their customers, to possess shareholders who take on that vision, and to recognise their responsibility to the society of which they are part. A national conversation about how to do this has not even begun. Until then, there will be more Philip Greens. Thank you very much to everyone who listened to The Hi-Lo. You can rate, review and subscribe on iTunes. It helps boost us in the charts and helps other people to find us. I know you love my boost.
More boosty.
Boost. You can email us, thehiloshow@gmail.com, or tweet us at thehiloshow. Boost!
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.